Alrighty. Daniel chapter 8. Records a vision that Daniel received in the third year of the reign of King Belshazzar. But somebody want to jump in? Let me organize my thoughts real quick.
Hello.
There's a guy, stuff happens.
Nice.
We're here.
Ta-da!
Yep.
That's pretty much all you need to know. An
extremely summarized summary.
Yet extremely
of all stories.
No, not of all stories. Some of them have a girl who does it.
Sexist.
Or maybe even stars.
Whoa.
All right,
or
so
animate objects.
Daniel, what's Daniel chapters 1 through 6? What's the genre of Daniel chapter 1 through 6?
History.
History, yeah. And so 7 through 12 is...
No. There's a phrase I'm not doing.
Well, you had it right.
Prophecy?
Prophecy, yeah.
Apocalyptic.
That's where I was
from. Whoa! Yeah. Some people would say apocalypse.
Stephen would.
I'm just going to say prophecy.
Ha!
So the last time we met, the time before, was chapter 7, and we went through that vision and what was in that vision.
It was a courtroom, I think.
There was a courtroom. What was before the courtroom?
The beasts?
Yeah.
The
wild
beasts.
The
four beasts. And the four beasts represent what?
The king.
Different kingdoms.
Four different kingdoms, yeah. You remember what four kingdoms?
Babylon, Greece, Rome.
Persia.
Babylon,
Medo-Persia.
Medo-Persia, Greece, and Rome.
Going
yeah.
By the Nebuchadnezzar statue.
Exactly. It lines up with the Nebuchadnezzar statue. All right, so this vision has two animals in it, and each of those represent a particular kingdom. And what's beautiful is that the angel actually tells you, in so many words, what kingdoms they are.
That's so helpful.
Doesn't just describe the kind of kingdom that it is. It tells you, it's this kingdom, by name. Whereas with the four beasts, we had to do our own historical work, right? Yeah, so that does help in a lot of areas. It also presents some problems in other areas that we gotta like understand clearly. So what we're gonna do is we're gonna read through the vision first and go through it really carefully, so we make sure we understand exactly what Daniel saw, and then we'll go through the interpretation as we read through it the first time. We'll interpret as we go to the second half of the book. So that should make sense once we start doing it. But to start with, someone want to very carefully read Daniel chapter 8, verses 1 through 14.
Very carefully.
Yeah.
So slowly and deliberately.
Yeah. I'll be making note of every detail, because there's lots of details in this vision.
In the third year...
There you go.
Of the reign of Belshazzar, the king, a vision appeared to me, Daniel, subsequent to the one which appeared to me previously. I looked in the vision, and while I was looking, I was in the citadel of Susa, which is in the province of Elam. And I looked in the vision, and I myself was beside the Ulai Canal. Then I lifted my eyes and looked, and behold, a ram which had two horns was standing in front of the canal. Now the two horns were long, but one was longer than the other, with the longer one coming up last. I saw the ram butting westward, northward, and southward, and no other beast could stand before him, nor was there anyone to rescue from his power, but he did as he pleased and magnified himself. While I was observing, behold, a male goat was coming from the west over the surface of the whole earth without touching the ground, and the goat had a conspicuous horn between his eyes. He came up to the ram that had the two horns, which I had seen standing in front of the canal, and rushed at him in his mighty wrath. I saw him come beside the ram, and he was enraged at him. And he struck the ram and shattered his two horns, and the ram had no strength to withstand him. So he hurled him to the ground and trampled on him, and there was none to rescue the ram from his power. Then the male goat magnified himself exceedingly. But as soon as he was mighty, the large horn was broken, and in its place there came up four conspicuous horns toward the four winds of heaven. Out of one of them came forth a rather small horn, which grew exceedingly great towards the south, towards the east, and towards the beautiful land. It grew up to the host of heaven, and caused some of the host and some of the stars to fall to the earth, and it trampled them down. It even magnified itself to be equal with the commander of the host, and it removed the regular sacrifice from him, and the place of his sanctuary was thrown down. And on account of transgression, the host will be given over to the horn, along with the regular sacrifice. And it will fling truth to the ground, and perform its will and prosper. Then I heard a holy one speaking, and another holy one said to that particular one who was speaking, "How long will the vision about the regular sacrifice apply, while the transgression causes horror, so as to allow both the holy place and the host to be trampled?" He said to me, "For 2300 evenings and mornings, then the holy place will be properly restored."
All right. So, give me a brief overview. What happens in this vision?
A lot of horns and animals hitting each other.
What two animals?
Goat and a ram.
Goat and a ram. So in this picture is actually surprisingly accurate. So it's got the canal of Ulai, right? It's got the goat over here, not on the ground, right? He comes over the whole earth without touching the ground. It's got the ram over here. Yeah.
What does my ram look like, though?
I don't know.
Every time I said ram, I thought...
Are these drawn to scale?
I don't know. So let's talk about the ram first. That's the first animal they see. What's its descriptors?
Two horns.
Both long, but
one longer than the other,
and
longer one came up last.
And what's it doing?
Charging.
Butting.
Yeah, charging. Butting.
Wait, is it going westward, northward, and southward all at the same time?
Westward, northward, and southward. So it's like butting northward, and then butting southward, and then butting westward. All right. Good. So we understand what the ram is doing. Now, what's the goat doing? What's he like? What's he got? Got one conspicuous horn, right?
Between his eyes.
All right. And what does he do to the ram?
Shoot the rainbow out of it.
Not quite.
Close. No.
Oh.
He wrecks it. Yeah. Well put.
Throws it to the ground.
Shatters its horns. Throws it to the ground. Then what happens to this goat and his horn?
Stretches.
The large horn became strong. Then it was broken.
Yeah, it became strong, and right as it became strong, the height of its power, it was broken. What comes up in this large horn's place?
Four more horns.
Four more conspicuous horns.
So you just imagine a goat, and he's got a big horn, and it breaks off, and then four horns come up in this place.
Yeah.
All right.
It's normal.
Then what happens with these four horns?
A small one.
Yeah, a small horn comes up.
But another one.
But it grows to be very big.
Grows to be very big. Which directions is it growing?
South and east.
And?
Toward the beautiful land.
Three geographical descriptions. Grow great, even as the host of heaven. How would you describe this little horn and what it's doing?
Yeah, boss.
Conquering, all right, yeah. Maybe boasting.
It magnified itself to be equal with the commander of the
Right, magnifying itself. Good, okay. And what does it do to the sacrifice system? That's verse 11.
Remove his daily sacrifice from his place of sanctuary because of rebellion. A host along the daily sacrifice will be given over.
Yeah, given over, overthrown. Removes the regular. The ESV actually renders it really well. Came great even as a prince. It, the regular burnt offering was taken away from him, and the place of his sanctuary was overthrown.
Isn't that so? That's similar to what the beast did in the earlier vision.
Yeah. So you remember in
tears down the wall. Basically, or this
the little
sacrifice.
Horn does that. Yeah.
Hey.
Paul.
Hi.
Time for
bed. Time for bed. Good night.
You got me too.
Okay.
Sleep tight.
Every time.
I just like how he acts like he's like surprised. Stephen.
So cool. I came in here. You were here.
Yeah, it's very similar to the little horn from chapter 7, right? The little horn comes up out of the last beast, and he boasting, and he magnifies himself, and he makes war with the holy ones, and then he cuts off the law, and yeah, so we got similarities here to previous characters. So as good Bible interpreters, you should think to yourself, is that the same person? And don't answer that question too quickly. But keep that question in your minds. Daniel finishes receiving this revelation, this vision, sees that he's going to put overthrow the offering in the sanctuary because of the transgression, again, a weird phrase, and will throw truth to the ground and will act and prosper, and he wants to know how long, or excuse me, the holy ones are talking, right? So then Daniel sees two angels talking to each other. One of them says to the other, how long is this going to go on? How long, specifically, what is he asking about how long will it? What does he say?
How long will this happen? How long will the events of this vision last?
Right.
The sacrifice, the rebellion, and the giving over of the sanctuary and of the host.
Right.
So when will all the bad things end?
Yeah. And what does he say? How long is it going to go on?
800 evenings
and mornings.
Okay, and so also as a good Bible interpreter, you're going to, since we already identified a similarity to the little horn, you remember there was a specific time frame given for that one, right? What was the time frame given for that one? For the little horn, when he was going to put an end to the law. Chapter 7.
I can't remember.
I don't remember what
a time, times, and half a time,
which adds up to
3 years.
Three and a half years, yeah. That's what we said. So, like I said, as good Bible interpreters, you're going to see, 2,300 evenings and mornings. I wonder how many years that is. How many years is that?
I have no idea.
Yeah, no.
Actually.
6.8.
I did the math.
Yeah. So that should
some
make conflict. You, as a Bible interpreter, go, huh.
Sounds like there's some conflict.
As you move on.
Uh-oh.
So just keep that,
that
in your mind as we move on through the text.
Wait, what do we keep in our mind?
The fact that this particular little horn is going to do something, is going to last for 2,300 days, which is 6.8 years.
Oh, no, I just want to make you go, again.
Oh, okay. Well, no, I'm not going to do that again. But everybody with me.
Yes.
The similarities and dissimilarities between the previous little horn that we saw in the previous video. Okay. Alright, I think we got a clear picture of what happened in the vision. I'm going to read the angel Gabriel part. So, verse 15, when I, Daniel, had seen the vision, I sought to understand it. And behold, there stood before me one having the appearance of a man. I heard a man's voice between the banks of the Ulai, and it called, Gabriel, make this man understand the vision. So he came near where I stood, and when he came, I was frightened and fell on my face. But he said to me, understand, O man, that the vision is for the time of the end. And when he had spoken to me, I fell into a deep sleep with my face on the ground. But he touched me and made me stand up.
He fainted.
Yeah, he fainted. He said, behold, I will make known to you what shall be at the latter end of the indignation, for it refers to the appointed time of the end. Okay. So what happened here?
So he's sitting, standing there and he's confused.
Confused? What's he?
Some guy showed up.
He sees one with the appearance of a man. And this is a thing that throughout Daniel we see when someone with the appearance of a man shows up, it's usually an angel. So he's, we can go with that for now. He sees an angel. And what does he hear?
A voice calling out for this angel to explain the vision.
Right. He calls this angel by name.
Gabriel.
Which is the first time Gabriel is mentioned in the Bible by name.
Woo!
All right.
Hello, Gabriel.
Yeah. Fun little fact.
I wonder why.
You know the other times that he's mentioned by name.
When?
Yeah. When else has he mentioned by name?
In the New Testament?
Yeah. When in particular?
Come on, Bethany.
Gosh!
We studied this
when?
Together.
When, Stephen?
We've studied a lot together, so...
Can I have something to do with Mary?
Yeah, there you go.
Matthew or...
We went through
Luke
the book of Luke together, and Gabriel appears to Zechariah.
Yeah,
and strikes him mute, and then he appears to Mary and says you'll have... the announcement of Christ.
Huh.
This is the other time that Gabriel shows up. in fact, he's only mentioned by name a couple places in the Bible. Maybe it's important. So again, this good Bible interpreter, you're going to say, huh.
Can we let some air in? I'm kind of dying.
I know, I'm looking a little bit different.
Okay, and so what does Gabriel say to him?
It's about the end time.
It's about the end time, or time of the end. And so, again, as Bible interpreters, you can say, what end is he talking about? So what would the things that pop in your head be? What end is he talking about? What do you think?
The end of the Bible?
The end of the Bible, so like the end of everything, the whole earth and creation. And that's one possibility. What might be some other possibilities when he's talking about time of the end? What is Daniel and all of Israel in the midst of right now?
Captivity.
Okay, so maybe the end of the captivity is what he's talking about.
Mm-hmm.
What else do you think? Maybe he's just straight up talking about Daniel's own life.
This is like latter time of wrath.
There you go, latter time of wrath.
For the vision pertains to the appointed time of the end.
Good. This is where he, yeah, so he says it again, right? A couple verses later, and he explains what he means by the end. Behold, I will make known to you what shall be at the latter end of the indignation, is how the ESV renders it. For it refers to the appointed time of the end. So, what end is he talking about?
The
end.
No, specifically.
Doesn't even matter.
Just word for word.
The
what end is he talking about?
Or the latter time of wrath.
The end that can be described as the latter end of the indignation, the latter end of wrath. Okay. That's the end he's talking about. Whether or not that's the end of the end of the end, don't know yet. But we know that it's described that way. Move forward with that noted. Alright. Then the angel starts explaining the vision. So, first, he says, verse 20. As for the ram, remember it had two horns, one was longer than the other. These are the kings of Medo-Persia, or Media and Persia.
So stronger kingdom, and the
yeah, there you go. So
weaker kingdom.
Yeah. All right. So using all of our information from the previous chapters, what beast and element did we link with Medo-Persia?
The beggar.
The bear.
With the ribs in its mouth.
With the ribs in its mouth.
Lopsided.
And it was lopsided. Okay, so we've got a few things that sort of are lining up. It's lopsided, right? And this ram has two horns, one that's longer than the other. It's also lopsided.
Mm-hmm.
I think the ribs in the mouth also line up. There were three ribs, or three sides. And what is this ram doing? What's its other description?
Bucking.
It's budding in three directions.
West,
right?
North, south.
Yeah, west, north, and south. I'd say that's a couple things that line up. So that kind of confirms for us, yeah, our interpretation that the bear was Medo-Persia is accurate, because this ram that has similar characteristics to the bear, the angel says, is Medo-Persia. Okay. Verse 21. And the goat is the king of Greece, or you might say kingdom of Greece. Remember, we talked about how king and kingdom kind of interchangeable.
Because then he goes on to say, the first king.
Exactly.
That's an actual king.
And the great horn between his eyes is the first king. Alright. Yeah, who's the first king of Greece?
Alexander the Great. Ish?
Yeah.
Ish?
I
mean,
the
that
first
would be
conspicuous
the
king of Greece.
Well, it's
yeah.
a big horn. It's a conspicuous.
Yeah.
It's a large horn, so it would have to be a more prevalent king.
Exactly, yes. Yeah. Yeah, and Greece wasn't really Greece until Alexander the Great showed up. It was Macedonia until Alexander the Great showed up. He started conquering and then it turned into Greece. So yeah, Alexander the Great. We know our history. Good.
Is there a reason that like they classify the goat, like say like male goat?
Because the word in Hebrew is masculine. Whereas there's a different word for a female goat.
Got it.
So that we're clear as English speakers that it's a
masculine goat.
Because I think we use goat regardless.
Yeah.
Why does my translation say that it's a shaggy goat?
I'd have to go find the exact word. I don't know if you guys have noticed that there's lots of variation in the translations. This
right.
is a weird.
What?
No.
Huh. Ah. I'm shocked. The more
weird passage know. With lots of kind of unique words. So.
Shaggy.
Apparently shaggy.
Yeah, shaggy.
No, Reggie.
Very important to note that.
Reggie.
Reggie.
Reggie. I was gonna say Reggie.
So Alexander the Great, we were thinking, hey, maybe that's the first horn. What happens to this horn?
Breaks.
It breaks. When does it break?
After it.
It gets powerful.
Yeah, the height of its power.
Uh-huh.
Which also lines up with Alexander the Great, right? Conquers the world at age 33. He dies suddenly.
Wow.
At the height of his power, leaving his empire without a successor.
Split into four.
Yeah.
Four leaders.
What happens? So, yeah, the Diadochi Wars. His four generals essentially battle it out and divide up his empire.
Ptolemy.
Ptolemy?
That's the only one I remember.
Cassander.
Cassander.
Lysimachus. I don't know anything
else.
Lysimachus.
Lysimachus
and
Seleucus. And Seleucus. Yeah.
The two that are important are Seleucus and Ptolemy. Right. Remember
that Ptolemy I remember.
If you turn to this page on your notes, there's a big old map with Ptolemy and Seleucus.
Oh my god!
Ptolemy
is
a
great.
That one definitely. Know about that one. Seleucus.
Ptolemy is a big guy because he took Egypt, and Egypt is kind of the key to the
Mediterranean,
yeah.
No,
it's the first great world power known to human history, was Egypt. And then Seleucus took over all of the main Babylonian Persian territory, so it had Babylon, which was the second big world power. So
yeah, so the four winds of heaven would mean the north, south.
Yes.
Okay.
And obviously we understand horns represent kings. So when the four horns come up after it, we're talking about the four generals who took over Alexander's
kingdom.
Domain, yeah.
But without the same power.
But without the same power. Not with his power. Verse 23 is important. So at the latter end of their kingdom, when the transgressors have reached their limit. A king of bold face, one who understands riddles, shall arise. All right. Who is this guy, this little horn? I'm going to give you the two main ideas. First is Antiochus Epiphanes, Antiochus IV. This is a king of the Seleucid Empire. The Seleucids and the Ptolemies battle it out for about 100 years after Alexander dies. And they go back and forth having war and trying to really have a whole lot of war right where Jerusalem is. You see how their empires kind of line up right on the Holy Land?
It's shocking.
So always does. They're constantly battling and mowing over Jerusalem in the process.
Something's never changed.
Yeah. Antiochus Epiphanes comes along and he does a pretty good job of expanding the Seleucid Empire, beating back the Ptolemies a little bit. He makes headway into Egyptian territory, and Antiochus Epiphanes obviously was a Greek, and he did not respect the Jewish people or their religion, and he tore down a whole bunch of Jewish temples, replaced them with Greek gods. He stopped the sacrificial system, and this story is all recorded in an apocryphal book, First and Second Maccabees. If you,
oh, Maccabees,
yeah, the Maccabees.
Like, you know, if you say Maccabees, most people, yeah,
yeah,
definitely. So
yeah, essentially, he. How much of that story did tell? Hold on. What's up? Alright. Yeah, so he is very domineering over the Jewish people during this period, and he specifically stops the sacrificial system. And the story of him stopping that system is recorded in the Book of Maccabees, and his death is recorded as, in Maccabees, he's just struck suddenly with an intestinal illness, and he dies fairly quickly after that. That's the first idea of who is this little horn guy. The second idea of who this little horn guy is it's some future Antichrist character, the Antichrist. So people try and line it up exactly with the little horn from Daniel chapter 7. Say they're both the same guy, and they both are referring to a single future ruler who's going to do this kind of stuff. And then you'll get mix and matches of some of those things. Some guys will be like, Antiochus Epiphanes fulfilled some of this, and then there's like a typology pointing forward to the Antichrist, and the Antichrist will finally fully fulfill it all. I actually think that the good case can be made that Antiochus Epiphanes fulfilled all of this. I think Antiochus Epiphanes is this little horn, and it is a different person than the little horn from Daniel chapter 7, but with similar characteristics. We're going to see someone like Antiochus Epiphanes in the future. That's the Daniel chapter 7 little horn. The Daniel chapter 8 little horn, I think, is Antiochus Epiphanes. How to defend that? Well, let's go through and see what he does. So, start in verse 23. At the latter end of their kingdom, when the transgressors have reached their limit, that'd be the wars between Ptolemy and Seleucids, a king of bold face, one who understands riddles, shall arise. His power shall be great, but not by his own power. Underline that sentence, we're going to come back to it. And he shall cause fearful destruction and shall succeed in what he does and destroy mighty men and the people who are the saints. By his cunning he shall make deceit prosper until under his hand, and in his own mind he shall become great. Without warning he shall destroy many, shall even rise up against the prince of princes, and he shall be broken, but by no human hand. The vision of the evenings and the mornings that has been told is true, but seal up the vision. It refers to many days from now. the record of his death lines up with Antiochus Epiphanes. He shall be broken, but by no human hand. Okay? Struck with an illness by God, according to 2 Maccabees 9. Lots of the things that he does line up with what he's doing to the Jewish people, to the Ptolemies, and the wars that he's having. Three particular phrases in here that we kind of need to dig into. One is in verse 24. Two of them are in verse 24, excuse me. Start with the second one in verse 24, which says, near the end of the verse, "You'll destroy mighty men and the people who are the saints." Who are the saints? Who are the people who are the saints? Assuming that we're going with the Antiochus Epiphanes view, who are the saints?
The Jews.
The Jews, yeah. The 3rd century BC Jews who are there fighting off the degradation of their entire religious system by Antiochus Epiphanes. Assuming we're going with the Antichrist future king view, who are the holy ones?
Church. Sort
of. One answer might be the church. What might be another answer?
The Jews?
The Jews, yeah. Both of those would be legitimate possibilities based on how you're doing your parsing out your eschatology. Trying to give you both because
people will give you both.
Yeah, you'll hear both. So. I think it's the Jews, either way. I think even if this is a future thing, the tribulation is for the Jews. Tribulation is about the Jews. Yeah.
Oh, I was just kidding.
Depends on how you feel like about Antichrist.
Yeah. So what you mean by it's always the Jews' fault. The Jews did kill Jesus, but the Jews are God's chosen people, and he will restore their kingdom to them under
Give them
Christ.
The land from the Euphrates to the Nile.
The Euphrates to the Nile. They promised it to Abraham and his descendants, and they haven't gotten it yet. So that is one thing. Just training you to be good Bible interpreters instead of narcissistic Bible interpreters. When you see the people of the Holy One or the Holy Saints, yeah, don't immediately go, "Oh, that's me." Back up.
Dash my dreams of being somebody.
The first part of verse 24. His power shall be great, but not by his own power. What do you think about that verse?
Not quite yet, squirrel.
But it will not be by his strength alone.
Like it's given to him, but it's not because of anything he's done or who he is.
There you go. What's been the theme of the book of Daniel? What's been the main
control.
Message? Yeah.
Sure.
God sets up kings and God puts down kings. That was every single chapter, 1-7, right? So with Nebuchadnezzar, then Belshazzar, then Darius, and then all four nations. And the whole point over and over again was God is the one who's doing this. God is the one who's in control. He decides who's in charge on earth.
He'll have great power, but that's because it's been given to him.
Exactly. It's a message to the Jews. The language has switched back to Hebrew, by the way. This is for the Jews now. And he's saying, yeah, you're going to be dominated by Antiochus Epiphanes. He's going to wreck shop on
2,300
days.
One.
And it's all according to my ordination. I planned this. I'm in charge of this. I put this guy in power. And I'm going to take him out of power. He didn't have the power because by his own hand. And he dies, not by a human hand. Right? That's, again, this is the point of the book of Daniel. Every single chapter is stressing this point, that God is the one in charge of everything, kings included. So as a first century Jew, what's your response to that message?
You're crazy.
What's the proper response as a first century Jew?
Well, I don't know. I haven't thought about it.
I was just trying to give a smart aleck answer.
What do you think? You're reading that, and you see, not by his power, and he's going to die not by a human hand. You've been reading the book of Daniel and seeing over and over again, God is the one who sets up the kingdoms and kings. God is the one in control of this. What's your response? What's the proper application of this passage?
Praise God.
Yeah, it's a good start. Praise and trust in Yahweh.
I'd be like, okay, well, we'll see how that goes. You know, gotta get through it.
Yeah. You're also reading this in exile, right? Currently under the, at least the Persians. You know that the Greeks are coming based on this prophecy. And, your reaction is, things are going to get worse. I guess I'll trust God anyway.
What's new?
Yeah. I'm going to trust God anyway. That's...
Well, if he can set up kings and set them down, he can definitely deliver his people from captivity.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. This is just like a reassurance thing. You're not doing it for nothing.
Yeah. Just in case you get a big head, remember what's coming. Abraham believed God, and it was reckoned to him as righteousness. That's the point. That's the gospel. That's the application of the book of Daniel. That's the application for Christians of the whole Bible, is trust and believe in God. Because he's in control.
Easier said than done.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Takes a whole life.
So you're in captivity.
How we get?
9:19.
10 more minutes, alright. One last confusing thing to dig into a little bit. Verse 25. Antiochus Epiphanes, he shall even rise up against the prince of princes and shall be broken, but by no human hand. Who is the prince of princes? What do you think? What are the first things that pop into your head when you see a phrase like the Prince of Princes?
Gotta be a pretty important man.
Gotta be a pretty Moses. Important man.
The P in Moses capitalized.
I don't know why. Maybe that stupid kid's movie?
Prince of Egypt.
Alright. Moses.
I think of like Prince of Peace.
Prince of Peace. Jesus, put him on the list. Who else? I'll give you a hint. Turn to Daniel chapter 10, verse 13. And then keep reading. 10:13, and then 10:21, and 10:20.
A lot of princes.
Mm-hmm. A lot of princes there, right? 10:13, an angel is talking, telling Daniel why he was delayed. The angel says,
Prince of the kingdom of Persia.
The prince of the kingdom of Persia withstood me 21 days, but Michael,
the chief princes.
The chief of princes. Maybe the prince of princes?
Came to help me.
I was left there without the with the kings of Persia. He's talking about angelic warfare that's going on that we don't even recognize. Princes in this book is often used as a term for angels. Other substantiating thing to look at. The first time this phrase shows up, commander of princes, the word prince could be translated official, commander, chief. Usually it's translated official or commander in reference to an army. But we're looking at Joshua chapter 5. You guys remember this story? I hope you do. It's one of the weirdest, cool little passages in the Bible. But chapter 6 is the fall of Jericho. You guys know that one, right?
Mm-hmm.
March around the wall 7 times, 7 days, blow the trumpets, walls fall down. Before that, right before that, Joshua chapter 5, verse 13, when Joshua was by Jericho the night before, he lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, a man was standing before him with drawn sword in his hand, and Joshua went to him and said, "Are you for us or for our adversaries?" And he said, "No, but I am the commander of the armies of the Lord."
Oh, yeah.
"Now I have come." Joshua fell on his face to the earth and worshipped and said to him, "What does my Lord have to say to his servant?" And the commander of the Lord's army said to Joshua, "Take off your sandals from your feet, for the place where you are standing is holy." And Joshua did so. And the next day, the walls fell down. This weird little interaction with the commander of the Lord's army. Same phrase, by the way. As the, or at least the same commander of hosts is how it was described in when Daniel first saw the vision. And the Prince of Princes is how it's described in the angel's explanation of the vision. I think this is the same character all the way through. I think this is the angel Michael. He shows up in Joshua the first time as a commander of the Lord's army. He shows up here in Daniel chapter 8. He shows up again in Daniel chapter 10 and Daniel chapter 11 and Daniel chapter 12. And then he shows up in Revelation, guess what, 12 and 13, which we already lined up, is parallel to Daniel chapter 7. I think they're all talking about the same sort of events that are going on. And Michael is waging this constant war. And I literally do believe this. There's an angelic war going on currently that Michael is waging against the demonic forces in this world. And he's going to essentially leave. He's going to withdraw his forces. And the demons are going to run amok, and that's going to be the tribulation. That's going to be bring forth the Antichrist and the beast and all these other things. I think Michael is the restrainer that you guys putting together 2 Thessalonians. The restrainer will be removed, and then the abomination of desolation will come. Lots of people talk about the restrainer being the rapture of the church. I'm talking over your heads right now, aren't I?
I'm on the downside of my exhaustion. So
yeah, that's all right. Don't have time to get into that anyway. But I think Michael's the restrainer, and I base that partly off of Daniel chapter 8. But.
So he's going to go up against the leader of the angels?
Exactly. He's going to show up, and it's going to cause Michael and his angels to quiver a little bit. Okay. Last little bit.
So he's going to get so strong that even the angels will have some anxiety.
Yeah.
But then he'll be struck down without, but not by human hands.
Right. I think Antiochus Epiphanes was demonically motivated. So I think that's it's describing the angelic realities that are going on that are kind of behind the earthly realities of this man who was waging this war. And we're seeing this kind of straddled description of both the angelic realm and the human realm. And that's part of why it's so darn confusing. So many weird descriptions. As for the 2300 evenings and mornings, evenings and mornings are always treated as a day. Ever since Genesis chapter 1, it was an evening and it was a morning.
It was the first day.
The first day and the second day and the third day. I think it's 2300 literal days, 6.8 years about. And so the question then you have to do is, if this is Antiochus Epiphanes and we're talking about that, when does that 2300 days fall in Antiochus Epiphanes' thing? And there are plenty of different people who will offer different start and end dates to suggest.
Shouldn't start when the saints are being.
Yeah. So, but the question is, what event would we say was the start of
persecution of the saints?
Exactly. And so, well, it was when Antiochus Epiphanes officially stopped the sacrifices, and Mattathias went and attacked the guy from Maccabees chapter 9. And then the end was 2300 days later, and they find something. All that to say, it's loose. There's no clear cut. Oh, this is clearly the start of that 2300 days, and this is clearly the end. But there's plenty of dates within that range where you can sort of say, okay, it plumps right down in the middle of those
it
events.
Would make sense if you were to say that.
Yeah.
It was him.
The other view would have to say these 2,300 days is describing the entire tribulation. And so it's a round number, and it's not actually 6.8 years. It's not 2,300 days. It means 7 years total. It's describing the whole tribulation period, which we're going to learn more about in 2 weeks when we get to the second half of Daniel chapter 9, with Daniel's 70 weeks prophecy. A lot of stuff there.
Woo.
But everybody kind of understand Daniel chapter 8?
Yes.
What's the point, though? What's the application?
God's in charge.
And so what do you do as in response to that truth?
Yes.
Yeah.
I didn't
even find that one funny that time. That was sort of a...
Just the way you said it, though, was funny.
Yeah.
Like what you do is...
Rest or react to it.
Don't fight
praise
it.
God.
Praise him.
Yeah. Trust and obey. Verse 27, and I, Daniel, was overcome and lay sick for some days. Then I arose and went about the king's business. But I was appalled by the vision and did not understand it, or there was no one to bring understanding to me.
Another one of those, be quiet because it hasn't come true yet.
Exactly. Remember, this is the third year of Belshazzar. So we're back during Babylon before... the handwriting on the wall before the lion's den when he's receiving this vision, and Medo-Persia hasn't taken over Babylon yet.
How long did we say Belshazzar ruled for?
It's in your week one notes. Series of Kings.
Just curious.
I want to say it was 550 BC to 538.
It's a good chunk of time. Ish.
539.
Darn,
Stephen, I was expecting a lot of
value. Good, good, good.
Because when you read it, it always feels like it was just like that. It was just over like that, but maybe not so much.
Next week, we will do the first half of chapter 9, Daniel's prayer.